Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you the latest news from across Ukraine, update on Lord Cameron's visit to the US, and we speak to British volunteer Felicity Spector, who's been crisscrossing the country with the charity Bake for Ukraine.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Wednesday, the 10th of April, 2 years and 46 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today, I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols, assistant comment editor Francis Sternley, and British volunteer Felicity Spector. I started by asking Dom for the latest updates from Ukraine.
Well, hi, David. Hi, everybody. Great to speak to you again, Felicity. So Russia carried out an overnight attack on energy infrastructure in Odessa and Mykolaiv oblasts. That comes from Ukraine's Southern Defense Forces this morning. They say Russia targeted the two southern regions with a wave of drones, 12 of which were downed over Mykolaiv, while another two shot down over Odessa, Odessa Oblast, that is. Critical infrastructure in Odessa in the city was also hit with missiles. The State Emergency Service said a blaze was put out at an energy facility in Mykolaiv district, as well as another fire in the coastal settlement of Okhachiv. That was caused by drone fragments that had been hit in the air coming down. Local authorities were forced to introduce emergency shutdowns as a result of the fire at the energy facility in Mykolaiv district, said Governor Vitaly Kim, but everything was back up by 8 a.m. local time. Elsewhere in Ukraine, the Air Force says it destroyed 14 of 17 Shahed-type drones over Odessa, Mykolaiv, and two Kh-59 missiles. That was the early morning update from the Air Force. The drones were said to have been launched from Cape Chada in occupied Crimea. And Russian forces also targeted Ukraine with at least two Iskander K cruise missiles and one Iskander M ballistic missile. The Air Force didn't specify whether those missiles were intercepted, which, as I've said before, leads me to assume that they were not. They would have said so otherwise, I feel. Now, Ukrainian Navy spokesperson Dmitry Pletenchuk, he said a Russian Kamov Ka-27 helicopter was shot down over Crimea. Kamov, known as Helix to NATO, principally a naval helicopter. It's got contra-rotating blades, so the airframe is shorter. Didn't need a big tail boom out the back. Newton's second law and all that. They also make it a very stable platform, so it hovers flat. It doesn't hover sort of slightly tail down as most helicopters. So it makes it a good platform for anti-submarine warfare, search and rescue, that kind of thing. You'll see them carried on ships accordingly. K-27s, we think, currently used by Russian forces in the Black Sea looking for Ukrainian naval drones and so on. Now, also today, Russia's defense ministry said that one of its Mi-24 Hind attack helicopters had crashed close to the western coast of Crimea. Quite an old helicopter, updated, but still very, very capable. Gunship, but can carry people in the back. It's not known if anybody was in the back of this one, but it's thought both aircrew were killed. That suggestion coming from Russian military blogging community. the losses of these aircraft take to 325, the number of Russian helicopters lost since the start of the full-scale invasion, according to Ukraine's general staff. Now, elsewhere, Ukraine's State Emergency Service, this is reporting from the Kyiv Independent, the State Emergency Service said they pulled another couple of bodies from the rubble of the apartment building following the 9th of April strike on the Kostanivka area of Donetsk Oblast. That was the strike partially destroyed a two-story building. People killed at the time, but rescue operations have updated the casualty list there. Now then, from the ISW, the Institute for the Study of War, the US-based think tank, geolocated footage over the last few days shows Russian forces have continued their small advances, but continued is the important word there, I think. They've recently been seen to have advanced west of Avdiivka. They've likely captured Pervomayska, that's just to the northwest of Donetsk city. And they've also geolocated footage has shown them advancing to the south and southwest of Donetsk city as well. Now, in this morning's British MOD intelligence update, it talks about the Russian spring conscription efforts. And it's worth just noting, not only for the figures, but also there's been a lot of speculation lately about Russia's mobilising hundreds of thousands of people and a lot of comment that actually this is just normal. Other people say, no, this is their attempt to build up to 400,000, as they've said, et cetera, et cetera. So just to try and put a little bit of context around it. So British Defence Intelligence saying today that Russia continues, its, as in recent years, continues the model of conscripting soldiers each spring and autumn. The spring conscription effort commenced on the 1st of April, and around 150,000 people between the ages of 18 to 30 are going to be conscripted. That is consistent, they say, with numbers conscripted in previous years. These conscripts typically serve for 12 months in all branches of Russian forces. They are not typically employed in combat roles in Ukraine. They're generally used to garrison sites across Russia. They generally form separate battalions away from those battalions that are staffed by contract service soldiers. Some conscript soldiers likely serve in Russia adjacent to the Ukraine border to provide border security, but it's rare that they themselves, as formed units, are used in Ukraine. British DI say that Russian forces in Ukraine are staffed by contract service soldiers and some reservists mobilised since 2020. Conscript soldiers commonly put under pressure to enlist as contract soldiers and then liable for service in Ukraine. However, with some understatement, British DI, Defence Intelligence, say there's likely to be some reluctance among Russian authorities to risk combat casualties amongst conscript soldiers. It seemed to be, this is my words now, seemed to be one area that they view themselves as vulnerable to public opinion. Now, it would be unpopular, as OD say. They put the point that casualties amongst volunteer soldiers are more tolerated by society. And just to finish this off, Russia is seeking to recruit around 400,000 contract service personnel this year. That is to sustain its forces in Ukraine, but also as part of its announced plans to increase the size of the armed forces to just over 1.3 million this year, leading to or building to their aspiration of 1.5 million. So just trying to give a bit of context there, David, on what this latest conscription is and how it fits into the regular pattern. And it will be part of that effort because these individuals will be encouraged. Quite how, we're not sure, but put under pressure to sign contracts. But this is not in and of itself part of the expansion of the Russian army. I'll take a little pause there, David.
Well, thank you very much, Dom, for that. Francis Sternley, can I go to you next? What have you been looking at in the political and diplomatic space?
Thanks, David. We discussed in detail yesterday Lord Cameron's visit to the United States. So for full context, I would point listeners to Tuesday's episode. As planned, British Foreign Secretary spoke alongside Secretary of State Antony Blinken in the afternoon, though interestingly, in his opening remarks, was keen to emphasise that it was not for political leaders to tell legislators in a foreign country what to do, adding, "It's just that I'm so passionate about the importance of defending Ukraine against this aggression. I think it is absolutely in the interests of US security that Putin fails in his illegal invasion." He went on, "It's so important that the outcome of all of this is a strong and secure NATO with full US and Atlantic support, rather than a setback for the Western alliance, a victory for Putin in a sense we don't stand by our allies and friends at their time of need. That's the spirit in which I'm here. I'll make time for any people in Congress who would welcome a conversation. Yet it seems not many in Congress took him up on his offer. As Patrick Winter, the diplomatic editor at The Guardian, summarises, that bid to persuade Trump to permit the US Congress to push through the military aid for Ukraine appears to have failed, as Cameron was not even granted a meeting with Congressional Speaker Mike Johnson. Johnson instead found himself assailed by Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who renewed her threats of a snap vote to remove him from office for even countenancing a vote on the aid bill. She said, "This has been a complete and total surrender to, if not complete and total lockstep with, the Democrats' agenda that has angered our Republican base so much and given them very little reason to vote for a Republican House majority." Now, we don't know whether Cameron was sent as a de facto representative of Western leaders, not just Britain. But if so, I don't think he was the wisest choice. Whilst he was a former prime minister, he's been extremely critical of Trump in the past, as Tony highlighted yesterday, as well as being symbolic of a certain kind of Englishman. He's comes across as aristocratic. He's an old Etonian. Rather high and mighty, really. And given the tensions in the Republican Party, even the perception of a hectoring by a British Foreign Secretary was hardly going to sit well. The fact is that the Republican fraternity is arguably unpersuadable now, this close to an election. It can only be forced to act, though how exactly remains to be seen. All eyes are on Trump and whether there is some movement with regard to NATO and Ukraine. But I don't think many people are holding out much hope. Although, still, there is an expectation that that military aid package will pass at some point. But when, we have no idea. In other news, China vowed today it would not accept criticism or pressure over its ties with Russia after Washington warned that it would hold Beijing responsible if Moscow makes gains in Ukraine. As James Kilner spoke about yesterday, China and Russia pledged Tuesday they would strengthen strategic cooperation as Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, held talks with President Xi directly and his top diplomat. Quite a significant development, as we discussed. While China says it's a neutral party in the war, it has been criticised, of course, for refusing to condemn Moscow for the offensive and for indirect support for the war effort by continuing to trade with Russia, as well as, we believe, backdoor weapons of a certain type. We have told China directly, if this continues, it will have an impact on the US-China relationship, Kurt Campbell, the US Deputy State Secretary, said on Tuesday. The fact is, though, as we reported all the way back when the war began, perhaps the key window to enforce that, laying out exactly what the cost for China would be if it continued with its relationship with Russia, was when the conflict first erupted, when there was that initial shock. Now that has subsided, and I think many would argue that such a window has closed now, meaning that China can be much more overt with its relationship with Russia, and unashamedly so. That was not the case in the first 6 months to a year of the war. Now, onto the EU. According to the Kyiv Independent, the bloc is readying its 14th package of sanctions against Russia, which should be adopted this spring. That's coming from the EU Trade Commissioner, who spoke in Brussels yesterday. It is likely to include an extensive list of restrictive measures with a strong anti-circumnavigation angle in the maritime sector, for example, as Russia continues to try and violate the price cap for its oil exports, said the official who serves as the EU Commission's executive vice president. So, an indication there that they are trying to find ways around circumventions of sanctions. But I think it's very, very difficult, as we've discussed quite a few times recently. The EU, the US and the G7 countries, of course, imposed, just as an example, the $60 per barrel price cap on Russian seaborne oil in December 22. Whilst initially successful, Russia later managed to largely dodge the effects by the use of its shadow fleets of uninsured tankers, as well as a lot being purchased by nations who've decided not to opt into sanctions. So really, further evidence, if needed, of the challenges of this. And it seems that every time new measures are brought in, they are immediately dispelled by there being a solution found from the opposite parties. We are seeing a numerous and troubling development, I think, on lots of different strands. But that's where we are today, David.
Well, thank you very much, Francis, for that. Dom, I know you've got one more update to talk us through. It's regarding mobilisation in Ukraine before we go to Felicity.
Yeah, just a note, just to update us on the mobilisation bill going through Ukraine's parliament, the Verkhovna Rada. So they started debating the second reading of the mobilisation bill, currently going through its stages. This is lawmaker Alexei Honcharenko speaking this morning. So this bill, the most important part of the bill is the provision to extend the mobilisation ages to between 25 and 60, so reducing the bottom end down to 25. This is a bill introduced by Roman Kostenko, the former senior SBU commander, now an MP, albeit back in uniform since the start of the full-scale invasion, the guy I interviewed when we were in Ukraine in February. You'll find that interview in the March 20th episode, I think. So this bill is a key component of President Zelensky's efforts to ramp up mobilisation this year. He said back in December that the original version of the bill would seek a draft of between 450 and 500,000 additional conscripts, although that's now been watered down. The commander-in-chief now, General Oleksandr Syrsky, speaking on March the 29th, he said that that number had been significantly reduced, but didn't put a figure on it. The Parliament's considering the latest version of the bill after the first very contentious proposal was withdrawn. The resubmitted draft law passed its first reading on February the 7th. They then had 4,000 amendments to the bill, which they've been working through, and hence the second reading today. Now, the bill will come into force after it passes its second reading and is signed off by the President. Separately, David, but also this morning, the Parliament passed the first reading of a bill permitting military service of citizens convicted of minor offences. Now, this does not include those convicted under serious and violent charges such as murder, sexual violence or crimes against national security, but is a change, obviously. And as with the mobilisation bill, this has to pass its second reading and be signed into law by the President. So we'll keep an eye on that one as well. But just thought I'd keep you up to date with where Ukraine mobilisation efforts are.
Thank you very much, Dom. And I would say to our Ukrainian listeners, do get in touch. It'd be very interesting to hear from you how this bill is being reported in the Ukrainian media, what you're hearing about it, but also what people are saying about it. And the apprehension, I imagine, for younger people that very soon they could be called up into the military. So do get in touch on that. It'd be very interesting to hear from you. Well, let's go to Felicity Spector, friend of the podcast, British volunteer out in Ukraine. Felicity, would you just reintroduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about what you've been up to in the last few weeks?
Hello there. Yes, and thanks very much for having me on. So I've been out here since the beginning of February, and I'm doing lots of interviews with people who work or volunteer in food because I'm writing a book about how they've been helping Ukraine during this time of war. And also I'm here with a charity called Bake for Ukraine, and we have a mobile bakery based here in Odessa, which we're about to take on the road to distribute bread to some villages in the south. So I've got a kind of dual role, but I've been traveling all around. I've been to most parts of Ukraine, it seems, a lot of train journeys. And I just got back from Kharkiv, which was my latest trip, and arrived back in Odessa this morning.
Well, Felicity, would you tell us a little bit more about Kharkiv at the moment? What's life like there? I mean, we seem to be reporting on it almost every single day, these glide bomb strikes that can destroy entire apartment blocks, the fact that many people, the electricity supply is intermittent as the power plants have been hit by Russia. Could you tell us about your experience there? Maybe take us into your mind's eye. What did you see and hear?
Yeah, I mean, so I've been on a few visits to Kharkiv, and at first I went there to speak to some small business owners who have opened cafes and restaurants since the full-scale invasion began, because I wanted to find out what it takes to have that particular kind of energy to decide to open a business during a war. And all of them said there's a particular kind of person who's decided to stay living in Kharkiv. A lot of people left, quite understandably, because it was incredibly horrific at the beginning of the full-scale invasion. The Russian troops were very close to the edge of Kharkiv. It sounded horrendous living there. So obviously a lot of people left, but some people stayed and others returned. And they now are very, very committed to making the city viable. and all said to me, if we all left, then there would be nowhere for any, there'd be no life left in the city, and we really believe in it. And a lot of Ukrainians hold a very dear place for Kharkiv in their hearts. It's, and seeing what's happened to it now is just absolutely horrendous. I've been a few times, and this time yesterday seemed very different. It was incredibly quiet. There was hardly anyone around, just a lot of police, which possibly could have been because Zelensky was there. I'm not sure, but it's not a place where you would particularly go for a walk or spend much time outside or decide to go anywhere shopping with your family or anything like that because of these aerial bombs. And there isn't much time for people to get to shelter. If you're lucky enough to be near the metro, that's very deep and it's kind of safe to go down there. But if you're not near a station or near anywhere, you know, just in the street, you don't really have a long time to run and find somewhere to hide. And so that's really terrifying because these are very dangerous, huge bombs. And in fact, yesterday afternoon at about 3 o'clock, two of them fell somewhere in the city centre. And I think there were four casualties immediately and people had to be dug out of the rubble. And that was in the middle of a weekday afternoon when people were just going about their business. So that's the situation for people. And the power also has made it really tricky for people to operate. People have got generators because obviously there's been problems with electricity before, but it's expensive and you've got to find fuel. And some places, which, I mean, these new businesses, one of them messaged me to anywhere where I could get a 30 kilowatt generator. We're happy to rent it, but we can't get hold of one because everyone's already using the ones that were available in the city. And I met one friend in the morning who'd come into the local bakery cafe because they had got a Starlink and several generators. He had no electricity at home. And he said, I can't even get Wi-Fi because there's nothing to power it. So I can't work. So I've come in here and at least here I can sit here and use the power and use their Wi-Fi connection. So at least he could operate. And then I think the power is turned on for people, if they're lucky, for sort of four to 6 hours in the day. And then they can use it and then they're just left in the dark. And it's very, very dark in Kharkiv at night without any street lights or anything like that. So, yeah, they're just desperate to get hold of air defence, basically. That's what everyone says. We need air defence. We need these patriots. We need to protect people who live and work in the city because it's 1.5 million people. And you can't subject people to this kind of terror and just sit there and watch. Everyone just wanted to appeal to the West or to people who have patriot systems just sitting there not doing anything useful to lend them or give them to Ukraine at a time of great need like this.
And can I ask, Felicity, I mean, I was only in Kharkiv for around less than 24 hours, really, last summer, but walked around, saw as much of it as I could. And I was really struck, first of all, by, and as I'm sure you'll know, many of our listeners will know, really what a great city, what a beautiful city it is, especially in the centre, but also how it had obviously lots of damage. There's still lots of shell spatters and on the buildings. There's lots of MDF in the windows in a way that you don't really encounter in Kyiv and certainly most of the cities further west. Would you say in your trips there that this has got worse? You said there were fewer people. What does it look like when you're looking around the main squares?
I mean, to walk through, so it's interesting. It's Freedom Square, which is the big main square where the sort of city administration building is. It's the biggest square in Europe. It was completely deserted, but you would normally expect to see people sort of walking around, and there's a little park thing in the centre and so on. And there was literally, there was a few cars parked, but there was but one or two pedestrians walking around. Interestingly, there's a cafe on one side of the square called Franik, and they were really badly damaged in a bomb attack in January. And they managed to completely rebuild the whole place. And now that's actually quite busy. You can't get a table there because people really wanted to come back and support it. Two of the other cafes that I had interviewed, the owners, one called Maker's Coffee and another one, Pakofuda, they had also both had windows smashed because of nearby missile strikes. And both of them had decided they'd boarded them up. And then they thought, sod it, we're going to rebuild them with glass again, which is kind of optimistic. And they had just had that done. So now it's obviously not the ideal place to have a big glass window, but they've got corridors and stuff. Somebody said to me, or if the siren comes on, they ask people to go to the downstairs or to the kind of walled off area at the back rather than have people sitting near a big window just in case, because you don't know where these things are going to fall. But yes, there's a lot more quite serious looking damage. I mean, you can walk up any of the main streets, and then there's suddenly a building which is half gone or sort of really burnt looking, or a big sort of hole gouged out of the roof. And it is quite shocking to see that in the middle of a city centre. It's a very big reminder that life is completely abnormal. But at the same time, people are just really trying to carry on as best they can, because what else can they do? One of Dimitri, who runs Makers, he said, oh, you know, maybe we'll open another branch, because I want to give people the place to go and have coffee and have this space outside their home where maybe they can get some work done. And he wants to still try and expand, but it's really difficult. At the same time, there are all these, I don't know whether you've reported these ops. A friend of mine told me her mum had received a text message saying there's a mass evacuation happening from Kharkiv, and they're all sort of made up, and it's kind of an attempt to panic people. And people know that they're fake, but at the same time, it must be quite unsettling to get something like that suddenly coming up on your phone. So there's all those sort of insidious things which you don't really see on the surface, but it must be also very disruptive. And the lack of sleep, because the siren is on all the time. It's hardly a moment when it isn't. And it's some people, I'm sure, turn it off at night because they just can't face another night of jumping up and down. But if you're there with a family or you're in a particularly vulnerable place, it's just exhausting.
And Felicity, could you tell us, when you're in these more dangerous cities like Kharkiv, do you see a lot of other foreign volunteers and foreign presence there? I mean, it's a lot more dangerous now. Has the volunteering from outside Ukraine tailed off slightly? What's your sense of that?
I mean, it's interesting. In Kharkiv, I did go and visit a couple of charities or volunteer organisations. There's one called Hell's Kitchen, which isn't connected to the Gordon Ramsay programme, but they have quite a big setup, and it's actually handily, it's in a basement area. So once they're down there, it's relatively secure, they think. So they have a lot of international volunteers, and they cook food and make bread and deliver it to some of the villages. I also visited the synagogue and spoke to the chief rabbi. They've also been cooking for people and delivering bread, not just to the Jewish community, but to lots of other hospitals and other villages and things. And there's another charity I visited, which called Unity and Strength, and they were helping some of the more remoter villages. There's one place near Izium, which was almost totally destroyed, and there's a lot of mines there. There's a demining operation going on. So as places become safe to move back to, some of the farmers and the people who lived in that village need a lot of help with rebuilding. So that charity is helping with that. And that there are some international people there. But I imagine that it's quite difficult now for someone coming from abroad to think, oh, yes, I'll go to Kharkiv or Odessa or even Odessa, where I am now, because it is a lot riskier. Whereas if you go to Kyiv, which is also under attack but has better protection for the time being at least, or somewhere in the west like Lviv, then it probably feels slightly less risky. But it would be a real shame. I mean, obviously there are a lot of Ukrainian volunteers, and they're the ones doing most of the work, and they're still turning up, amazingly, have the energy to keep doing that. But it would be a shame if people didn't feel that they could support these places which are actually in greater need.
Just one more question from me, Felicity, before I hand over, because I know that Dom and Francis have a couple as well. You're travelling an awful lot, so Kharkiv, Odessa, Kyiv, all these different places. Do you detect any change amongst the Ukrainians you meet with their views on the war? If you go to Odessa, is there a certain prevailing view about what they think is going to happen or should happen? Does that differ if you go to Kharkiv, or is there a broad countrywide agreement on where they think the country is?
It is really difficult, and I don't want to put words into people's mouths, because there's a lot of worry, I suppose, about how committed the West is. And that's, I think, the biggest issue. That's like, we can do this ourselves, but we do need some help. And it's not like you didn't promise this in the first place. You can't sort of half finish the job. I think a lot of people have relations in the armed forces, and obviously that's an incredibly worrying thing, and for soldiers themselves to worry about not having enough ammunition must be really, really impossible. So those kind of issues, I think, are weighing quite heavily on people. Nobody is talking about surrendering or negotiating. There's nothing like that. It's not that people say, oh, no, we can't keep going. It's just that this is a really difficult fight, and they really want and hope to still retain the support of the international community, because they feel that it's in everyone's interests for Ukraine to win the war. And but they can't do it completely by themselves. I mean, now they're building up domestic production of drones and all this kind of thing. You see people making drones at home. People are incredibly inventive about, you know, how they manage to operate. But it's there's a limit. They're ordinary people. They're not some kind of like superhumans. They do their best. And I've never seen people who are quite so adaptable and able to cope with kind of really difficult circumstances. But that's what I think people are saying is like, please don't stop supporting us. Don't forget about us.
Felicity, hi, it's Dom here. Thanks so much for joining us. It's lunchtime here in London. Francis's rumbly tum is going 10 to the dozen next to me. So let's make it worse for him. Let's talk about food. Your book, you're researching. What are you seeking to do? What are you hoping to do that hasn't been done before with reporting on Ukrainian food and recipes? And have you adjusted or included at all how Ukrainian restaurateurs and chefs and cooks have had to adapt to the uneven power supply? Have any new foods been developed? Any new recipes to be made in the absence of power or with very intermittent power? Just wondering what the focus of your book is.
So basically, I'm looking at stories of I'm basically telling stories of lots of different people who work or who volunteer in food, from volunteers who deliver to the frontline villages, bakeries which make free bread for people, these kitchens which cook for soldiers, and all sorts of aspects of how chefs are promoting Ukrainian culture, I suppose, through modernizing Ukrainian food. And interestingly, so people say in their grandmothers, like people are used to living without resources. During Soviet times, often things were in very short supply. In the 90s, even that there were power cuts and things. So they have remembered, luckily, the old sort of techniques of their grandparents, and do a lot of pickling and preserving. And everywhere you go, you'll see someone's mum will have sent them a big cupboard load of pickled tomatoes and pickled cucumbers and beetroots and things like that. I now have an entire suitcase full of them because everybody is very generous and always gifts you an enormous jar of pickles. And you're like, oh, thanks very much. Get that back to London. But it's those kind of things which people had to do in the past, which now stand them in very good stead, because when they have the availability, they quickly stash away a load of stuff just in case. So they have these cupboards full of things that will keep and don't need any cooking. And similarly, people are managing to sort of make things these dried foods, which they send to soldiers. Some quite sort of big name chefs have started doing sort of military meals, really good quality. And all you have to do is add some water and you can make sort of spaghetti carbonara or sort of porridge with dried cherries and cinnamon and things. So they're quite elaborate and not just some horrible basic bit of cardboard. And this is because people are just constantly thinking, what can I do to make things slightly less horrible?
Felicity, great to speak to you. Apologies for the rumbly tummy from me. I would have bought a slice of pizza beforehand, but I'd be worried that Dom would feed it to a dog like he did in Kyiv. But anyway, Felicity, it's been really... It's very interesting hearing your perspective. And as David said, you're travelling around the whole country at the moment. Of course, there's a lot of interest in the impact of the lack of there being a presidential election this year, as was expected. I'm wondering if you're seeing a fraying in trust in the government as a result, and particularly any critiques being made of President Zelensky. As we've talked about before on the podcast, that without necessarily critiquing the reasons that have been given for the lack of a presidential election, the fact that it would be extremely dangerous for people to have one for one, the fact is that there are many virtues of having an election because it releases pressure on the government that builds up beneath the surface of a society. Just wonder if you've got any sense of that, or do you feel that most people are very understanding of the state of play and why there can't be this election that was scheduled in March? Thank you.
Yeah, I would say so, because, I mean, Ukrainians are it's a very robust democracy. People have strong opinions, which they're not afraid to argue with each other. They enjoy having a kind of discussion about things without sort of having to pretend that they don't have an opinion. I do meet people who didn't vote for Zelensky and probably wouldn't vote for him in a future election. But because they're in a full-scale war situation, I think pretty much everyone understands that this isn't the time to have something that's as disruptive as an election without all the practical problems that would come up. And the priority is to unite behind whoever's in charge, make sure that the army has all the support it needs. And that's the biggest priority rather than individual political disagreements. I mean, you will get people sort of having a go on Twitter or something, but I think because everybody needs to let off steam about individual policies. But I think overall, most of the people I know who maybe weren't the biggest fans of Zelensky before the war and might not vote for him again are still very committed and very united behind him during the war, because that's much more important than any political disagreement.
Well, thank you very much, Francis and Dom, for your questions. Just before we go to our final thoughts, Felicity, is there anything more you want to say about the charity you're out with at the moment, what challenges you're facing, and maybe some of the moving moments you've encountered in your most recent trip?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've had quite a lot of a lot. It's been a long road, I suppose, to get to this point. So we have a mobile bakery which is now in Odessa, which we're going to take to Mykolaiv region tomorrow, and we have bakers coming from Kyiv to volunteer on board. And this is basically going to be a bit of a test run to make sure that all the technical stuff works and that we know how many loaves of bread we can make, how long it takes. We've got volunteers lined up who will then distribute them to villages in Kherson region. Originally, the plan had been to take it to Kherson, but there's a lot of new rules which were brought in after the situation deteriorated in parts of Kherson. I think 3 French and Swiss aid people were killed in quite a dangerous area, I must say. We wouldn't have gone anywhere like that. But they just basically banned foreigners from going unless there was a lot of permission. And we decided there's no point. We don't want to park a big vehicle somewhere which isn't very secure anyway. So we've been taking lots of advice, and these local volunteers know the area and are happy to drive in and out with supplies. But when you go and deliver bread to people, I mean, there's all sorts of places where people are so generous. I mean, the biggest thing is that people are so generous. We went to visit this elderly lady. I was with a charity guy near Izium, and she lived in this tiny cottage, which was just really dark and really cold. She was wearing all her clothes at once. We brought some bread to her and some filtered water because she didn't have a water supply. And she stood just a minute, she said. She went off and came back with a book of poetry. She said, here, take this. It was in Russian language anyway. I said, well, thank you very much, some Ukrainian poet. And then she went off again and then came back with a jar of cucumbers for me. And this lady had absolutely nothing, and we were bringing her aid, and she wanted to give us something back in return. And it's those kind of moments you just think, it's really humbling.
Absolutely. Well, in your final thought, do give us some of the details if listeners are interested in learning more about what you're out in Ukraine doing. Let's first, though, go to Dom or Francis. Who would like the first of the final thoughts?
Me, please. Keep our eyes on the flooding situation out in the east of Russia, the southeast of Russia, around the border with Kazakhstan, as we've been reporting on for the last few days. Not only the dam that burst in Orsk or collapsed in Orsk, but also wider flooding there. I was looking at Agence France Presse, AFP, earlier on today, and they're saying the Kremlin judged the situation, in their words, very, very tense in several regions of the Urals and Western Siberia, affected by the record flooding. And they say the flood peak has not yet been reached. So we've already seen very minor, and I do emphasize that, very minor public grumbling about the authorities' response to the flooding and the Orsk dam burst in particular. But these things can gather steam. So just keep an eye, let's all keep an eye on what's happening with the flooding out in the east and the government response to it.
Thank you so much, Dom. Francis Sternley.
Thanks, David. Yesterday, I offered a few thoughts on the strategic picture as it stands, where I mentioned that there is a presumption amongst many Western powers that Article 5 of NATO is watertight, as in that an attack on one necessitates an attack or response, should I say, from all. And therefore, that there is nothing that Putin can do beyond Ukraine, as it were, within the NATO sphere. But I just wanted to highlight a quote in Roland's excellent summary of what will happen if the US turns its back on NATO. He writes, "Contrary to popular belief, Article 5, the mutual defence clause in NATO, does not oblige America or any other ally to go to war in defence of another. It only requires them to consider a response. So any sign that the US is unwilling to back the commitment with force is a potentially fatal hole in its deterrent effect." He then quotes from Ed Arnold, the research fellow for European security at RUSI. He says, "I honestly think a lot of politicians in the West don't understand what NATO is, and I'm speaking as a former NATO officer. Russia could take the whole of Estonia, and the US could just send AWACS. It could impose sanctions. It could move an aircraft carrier around in the North Atlantic, and they would live up to the letter, if not the spirit, of Article 5. Europeans really need to understand that. Trump doesn't have to leave NATO to destroy it politically. He can just give one press conference saying he's not going to defend it." Now, I'll add a link in the show notes to that piece. And this is a really vital point. As Roland says, it's too often forgotten. The alliance lives and dies on its perceived strength and solidarity that there would be a strong response. It is not necessitated by the letter of the law. It is in the spirit of the law. But the spirit, as we know, can change and can be massaged with certain pledges that are then not delivered. So it does show the vulnerabilities of NATO. As soon as you get a major partner, the major partner of America, starting to sow discord about the idea that whether they would really do anything or do anything sizable, or might even withdraw if Putin were to further probe, that has a major destabilizing influence on the whole rest of the continent. So just something to be aware of, that when we assume NATO's strength because of Article 5, just remember that it's only as strong as its weakest link and its weakest words.
Well, thank you very much, Dom and Francis. Felicity, thank you so much for your time today. It's really good to hear from you. Would you like the very final words?
Oh, thank you very much. If you want to find out more about Bake for Ukraine, you can find us online at bakeforukraine.org. And I would also urge people to, if you can manage to buy things from Ukrainian companies that are selling abroad, there's often lists you can find of people who are able to sell their goods online. Just something to keep people going, because it's another really practical way of helping. It's just a time when I think Ukraine needs to know that we haven't forgotten about them, and that we are still here for them, and that we believe in what they can achieve with help. And I just really wanted people to know that just even retweeting things and talking about it and trying to keep it in the news is one of the most easiest ways and most important ways that you can help.
Well, thank you so much, Felicity Spector, Francis Sternley and Dom Nichols, for your time today. It's been really great to hear from you, Felicity. Do stay safe, and I'm sure we'll see you when you're back in London, maybe even to relieve you of some of the jars of pickled vegetables that you've been given in your travels, if you need any help, that is.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And, if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.